This recording is the property of the Winogren Foundation and cannot be used, rebroadcast, or otherwise rebroadcast without the express permission of the Foundation. This is the New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section Lecture Series at the Winogren Foundation for Monday, September 22nd, 2014. Lecture is Perspectives on Nation Unbound, the Transnational Migration in the Current Conjuncture by Nina Glick-Schiller.
I'm Leslie Aiello. I'm the president of Winogren. I'd like to welcome you again for another season of very interesting and exciting talks. And I'm going to turn it over to Janice, who's going to introduce the speaker. Welcome to Winogren.
All right. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our first, seems a little far back, our first New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section event for the year. And my name is Janice Sotokoff. This is my co-chair, Brian Boyd, of the Anthropology Section. This year, we're doing things a bit differently than we have in the past. We're having themed semesters. So in the fall, we're doing a theme called the Migration Lectures. And next semester, a related theme that might not seem apparently related is on the Anthropocene or climate change. We're doing a series on that and also this connection between climate change and migration, so this sort of segue one into the other. So today, to kick off our migration theme, it seems very wonderful and obvious that we should have Nina Glick-Schiller to be our first event of the year, and we're very honored to have her here and thrilled it worked out. She has done groundbreaking comparative research in theory on transnational migration, as well as diasporic processes on cities and cosmopolitan cultures, long-distance nationalism, and a host of other themes that I won't list the whole thing because we're going to focus on migration today. Nina Glick-Schiller is an associate of the Max Planck Institute of Social Anthropology in Halle-Saale, Germany, and a senior associate of the Max Planck Institute for Ethnic and Religious Diversity, and an emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of New Hampshire. She's carried out fieldwork in Haiti, the U.S., Germany, and in the transnational Caribbean, which is a location or space that she theorizes in her work on transnational migration. Nina has authored, edited, and co-authored numerous articles and books, and is the recipient of numerous academic honors and fellowships. The theme of tonight is on one of her co-authored books, and we're also thrilled to have one of the other authors tonight, Linda Bash, as our discussant. So this book was co-authored by three anthropologists, Linda Bash, Nina Glick-Schiller, and Christina Zantin-Blanc. And the book is called Nations Unbound, Transnational Projects, Postcolonial Predicaments, and Dematerialized Nation States, published in 1993. In this groundbreaking work, the authors investigate power differences within transnational social fields in relationship to the constitution of race, class, status, citizenship, and national identity. They analyze the contingencies within which and processes through which migrants create transnational social fields that connect them to two or more nation states. And I use Nina's own words to describe her work. So today's talk really historicizes the transnational migration paradigm really established in this book. And it considers today its analytical power within the changed and changing global conditions of today. So I'm not going to describe more on these factors, on these conditions that Nina's going to lay out in her talk. I will let her do that work. And would you join me, please, welcoming Nina Glick-Schiller tonight.
I want to thank the New York Academy of Sciences and Winogren for this invitation. It looks a bit like old home week here, and which is quite wonderful, although in some ways I feel I'm preaching to the choir when I give this talk. because the people I'm really concerned, the critique I'm trying to make is probably not directed to you all, but we can work on this together. And because the questions of how we respond to current fears about migrants and their transnational ties is pressing. Okay, talk more into the microphone. Can you hear me now? But let's see. Our current period, as we know, is one of precarious times. And in these times, migrants are increasingly targeted by political leaders as threats to social cohesion, a word they use a great deal in the UK, the social fabric, national security, and the quality of our entire life. I love this graphic. It sort of sums it up. Blame them for everything. Immigrants coming to take your jobs and wives, destroy your way of life and spoil your kids, give you diseases and create evil in general. They will do it in everything else as well. Dirty refugees from hell. So that's the climate, talking about climate change that we're living in. How are migration scholars to respond to this fear-mongering? One response, and one that has been very potent among U.S. scholars of migration, is that of the new assimilationists. Some scholars acknowledge that the idea that people of migrant background living across borders is, they acknowledge the idea that people of migrant background living across borders may be potentially threatening. But they offer as a solution the new assimilationism. In response to these transnational ties, what they've done is they play down the significance of the ties. They define them out of existence. Alejandra Portis has done this in a sort of a presto changeo. It has to be, it's only a transnational tie if it's very frequent and regular. If you build the house, buy a house, that's a one-time thing. It doesn't count. I mean, so they define it out of existence, and they demonstrate that transnational ties help the U.S. or the new country. And they've argued, finally, that transnational ties are just part of the assimilation process. The purpose of this talk is to counter the growing dominance of this neo-assimilationism by presenting an alternative vision, that of the global perspective on transnational migration, the paradigm that we presented in Nations Unbound. In 1994, in Nations Unbound, Transnational Projects, Post-Colonial Dilemmas, and the Deterritorialized Nation State, Linda Bash, Christina Zantin, and I, three anthropologists, argued for a transnational paradigm for the study of migration. Since that time, a vast new scholarship of transnational studies has developed, much of it driven by interests outside of anthropology. There have been literally hundreds of millions of dollars spent on research centers, and doctoral training. Interestingly, what I consider the most illuminating aspects of the paradigm are those that have been misread or ignored by most of transnational migration scholarship, including many anthropologists. Significantly, little attention has been paid to the global perspectives of the initial paradigm. Yet this paradigm can speak to our precarious times. So what I'm going to do next, can you hear me? What I'm going to do next is I'm going to outline what I think are the three major points in this paradigm that I think are foundational and why they are. Then I'm going to talk about five ways in which I think the scholarship has gone down dead-end roads. And then I'm going to talk about what I think needs to be done now. Okay? All right. So, among the transnational paradigm's foundational aspects are the following. One, Nations Unbound noted the foundational role of transnational family networks as mechanisms of social support and as an aspect of border-spanning care chains. Migrants arrive not as lone workers, but as family members enmeshed in ties of debt, obligation, and responsibilities that extend across borders. But note, The important aspect of this was that Nations Unbound positioned people who migrate and their descendants within the same structures of necessity as people who are portrayed as natives of a nation state. Okay? In other words, most migration scholarship and policy had divided those who live in a national territory. We're expected to maintain ties with our kith and kin when we move. Of course we maintain ties with. Move to another city, another part of a city, another part of the United States. Of course you keep up your family and friendship ties. But in migration theory up to that time, immigrants were seen as uprooted, as giving up those ties. That creates two categories of humanity, right? Those who are entitled to family and those who are not. By questioning the categories of difference imposed by state borders, Nations Unbound made visible and legitimated migrants' humanity. Our assumption was that rather than begin with the nation state as the unit of analysis, any discussion of migration must begin with an analysis of the networks of unequal, globe-spanning economic, political, and cultural power that affect conditions of work and life for everyone, everywhere. It was in this sense that our reading of nation states was unbound, and the book was at its core an argument against methodological nationalism, although we didn't use the term. Methodological nationalism is an intellectual orientation that assumes that the national borders of a state define the unit of study and analysis, equates society with the nation state, and conflates national interests with the purpose and central topics of social science. Our book was also entitled Nations Unbound because we were aware that by using concepts of blood and belonging, nation state building projects actually extended claims to populations living beyond state borders. In other words, key to the idea of nation state building is an idea that you belong to a state through descent. We use the term deterritorialized nation state to track the efforts of sending state officials to engage immigrants and their descendants in efforts at national political transformation and continuing identification. We focused on the level of states because it was on the level of a nation state imaginary that theories about migration, settlement, belonging, citizenship, and identity were configured in popular and political discourse. What we didn't anticipate that people would read the title of our book and nothing else and decide we weren't talking about states at all. You know, that somehow we were talking about a post-state era. That was not at all the case. But it was our perspective that was global. We situated our interest in state narratives of membership and difference within an analysis of the networks of globe-spanning, hierarchical, and institutionalized power. Therefore, these networks became our basic unit of analysis, leading us to call for a migration studies that reflected a global perspective. Foundational to Nations Unbound is the understanding that international migration cannot be analyzed as a product of disparate pushes and pulls exerted by countries of emigration and immigration. This is because countries are not separate, discrete entities, each with bounded economies and separate trajectories of national development. We finished the book immediately before the term globalization entered widely into the academic and public vocabulary, and Nations Unbound didn't evoke the term. But Linda, Christina, and I spoke of a global perspective on migration in order to ground our analysis of migration within the dynamics of the global political economy. We saw migration as rooted in the processes of capital accumulation, growing inequality, and accompanying processes of governance and legitimation. We grounded our transnational paradigm on David Harvey's work on processes of flexible capital accumulation, which strengthened our critique of the structural adjustment policies that we knew were devastating the Caribbean and the Philippines, the regions in which we worked. We described a restructuring capitalism that included deindustrialization and increasingly precarious working conditions as currency flowed more readily across state borders. Industries ran away to find deregulated workplaces, and a new international division of labor was built on hyper-exploited, racialized, genderized labor. It was in relationship to the networks of unequal institutionalized economic and military power that maintained these disparities that we theorized that migrants needed to, quote, hedge their bets. They did this by building and maintaining transnational networks and identities and establishing ways they and their descendants might live simultaneously in two or more nation states. That is to say, we did not ignore or underplay the significance of individual motivation, agency, affectivity, and daily life, but placed them within an analysis of the structures of necessity and opportunity as they were mediated within nation states, regions, global institutions, and processes. The concept of global perspective we deployed was far from new, of course. Various system theorists from Luhmann's to Wallerstein, historians of power such as Mann, and anthropological theories of global interconnection such as Wolff were part of the intellectual context out of which Nations Unbound arose. Our thinking was in keeping with Michael Mann, who said, quote, "It may seem odd for a sociologist to adopt, an odd position for a sociologist to adopt, but if I could, I would abolish the concept of society altogether." As migration scholars, our particular focus was to critique the nation state as a unit of study and analysis, critique, therefore, the concept of national society. However, I must note that by speaking of transnationalism on page 4 as the processes by which immigrants forge and sustain multi-stranded social relations and link their societies of origin and settlement, we reintroduced the concept of society we were trying to critique. Our formulation in the same paragraph about networks of relationship that connect simultaneously to two and more nation states was more reflective of our opinions, of our position, but scholars don't read to the end of the page. So only the first thing's been quoted over and over. The concept of transnational fields, defined as a network of networks, was central to our global perspective. The transnational social field stands as a methodological and theoretical intervention that challenges bounded concepts of the nation state as society. It is not a metaphor, but an approach to the social, a form of relational sociology that places social relations as central and investigates them without an assumption of boundaries. A concept of networks can be a key methodological and analytical tool or not, depending on how the tool is handled. An analyst can speak of networks in ways that flatten and elide relations of power as the rhizomic connectivities projected by Deleuze and Guattari. On the other hand, we urge researchers to trace networks in order to elucidate the unequal, globe-spanning relationalities within which economic, political, and cultural power become valorized and accumulated. Okay. Now, following the publication of a first wave of scholars, specifically calling attention to people living their lives across borders by using the term transnational, beginning with Connie Sutton and Sue McKeesky Barrow, and later Michael Kearney and Roger Rouse and Linda Christina and I, a whole second wave of authors developed and popularized a set of assumptions about transnational migrations that I consider leading to analytical dead ends, each in their own way abandoning the analysis of power. Tr- Drawing from major scholars whose work has influenced many others, I will now outline five key concepts that I have tended to define and misdirect the field. First, I want to speak about multi-sided ethnography, which is said by many, and this is a more recent tendency, to be at the heart of transnational migration. I begin with the question of methodology because I believe that methodology and theory are linked, and the current widely disseminated assumptions that transnational migration research requires multi-sided ethnography stems from the failure of many researchers to grasp the nature of the global political economy and its relationship to human mobility and immobility. It might seem obvious that methodology of transnational migration should, follow the people. And it is true that Linder, together with the Wiltshires, began to thinking about transnational migration by finding that respondents moved between Caribbean countries and the United States. It became difficult for those researchers, to define exactly where each respondent lived or belonged. However, in the paradigm we propose, the focus was on networks of connection rather than individual migration stories. In developing the comparative ethnographic analysis on which Nations Unbound was based, we followed the networks of connections between individuals of Grenadian, Vincentian, Haitian, and Filipino backgrounds, non-governmental and political organizations, businesses, and state institutions within New York City, the U.S., and across international borders, including international agencies such as the U.N. We noted that individuals might live in transnational fields even if they themselves were not mobile people. The methodological challenge engendered by our global perspective on migration was to study people's simultaneous engagements in multiple processes of emplacement and displacement that were situated in various nation states. Is this the same as multi-sided ethnography? It is not multi-sided ethnography, as the concept was developed by Marcus and Henertz and became broadly popularized among scholars of transnational migration. Marcus and Henertz projected a series of classic binaries that impede research and analysis. Let's see where I am. I'm on the wrong one. Sorry. Research and analysis. Marcus, in their analysis, is separated from there. Micro-level observations that are close up and personal are different from impersonal systems. In arguing for the necessity of multi-sided ethnography for transnational studies, Marcus and Henertz perpetuated misreadings of the nature of the single site, and that is my critique. Marcus assumed that to study in a single research site is to obscure the ways in which closely observed cultural worlds are embedded in more impersonal systems. That's his quote. In point of fact, the obscuring comes from his concept of site, not from the single site method per se. It is possible to do a multi-scalar analysis of power in a particular place. It is possible to go to many places and never examine the networks of power. It's not the site that makes, or the sites that make the difference. It's the way the framework of analysis, the paradigm that we take to our sites. In point of fact, daily life anywhere and everywhere is part and parcel of the meetings of trajectories of power, and these trajectories stretch across space, time, and often across borders. Okay, so we need that as part of our paradigm, not our understanding of a limited space of a single site. Okay, now the next slide, which you saw. I'm all the way up there. Okay. The next dead end I want to talk about is the communitarian notions of social space that have been popularized in the past 20 years, using concepts of transnational community, diasporic community, transnational social spaces, or transnational social formations, often interchangeably. Just going to read from this to explain to you why I think this is a problem. I wouldn't talk about the Caribbean, by the way, as a single social space, because I think that sense of bounding is exactly what we need analytically to cut against. The problem with the use of space is that any local space can be divided by politics, gender, and class, as Robert Redfield pointed out in his village studies. Whether it's a village or a city, communal identities often have to be constructed. They are not natural. So by imposing a concept of community or transnational community or diasporic community or transnational social space as a unit of study and assuming there's a communal sense there, our analysis predetermines investigation. There are political consequences for this approach that plague us today. The political consequences you can see so clearly in Europe, where right-wing politicians assail migrants for their self-segregating behavior that then requires integration policies. In urban planning, migrants are envisioned in living in social spaces outside of city-making processes. Meanwhile, social movement activists, envisioning migrants as encapsulated within their cultural communities, often neglect them in their efforts to build social movements for social justice, including the struggle for the commons. Okay, dead end three. In formulating a transnational migration paradigm, Nations Unbound critique previous assimilationist theories of migration that had portrayed immigrants as uprooted, in the sense that people of migration background were portrayed as abandoning their transnational relations and identities. Since I spoke about this already, in the purpose of time, I just want to point out that there's a politics to each of these dead ends. And what happens with this kind of assimilationist analysis is that the new assimilationists reassert the lens of the nation state. They reassert methodological nationalism, and because they're unwilling to take a stand on the nature of the capitalist system and the imperialism of their own nation states. So since they don't want to make a political analysis, they're left with a defensive analysis of migration. If they don't have a framework that explains why people migrate, they don't have a framework that explains why differential power, then of course the only thing they can do is say that transnationalism is really not a problem. Furthermore, they talk about the second generation to assure us that transnational practices among the second generation change and are diminished. Nations Unbound, on the other hand, argued against lineal models of acculturation and assimilation because of the need to address ongoing issues of racialization, precarity within ever-changing global conditions, and the contradictions that these engender across the generations. Headlines every day point to complex entanglements of transmigrants with cross-border political and religious movements. The new assimilationists offer no analytical framework with which to sort out the role of transnational networks at play within various conflicts, the role of imperial and corporate interests and the arms industry, and the desperation and aspirations of people left with nowhere to go and nothing to hope for. Dead end four. The migration and development mantra. What has come to be referred to as the migration and development mantra of the development experts is also a product of methodological nationalism. Even while lauding transnational flows of migrant remittances as central to the development of migration sending countries, this prestigious development strategy resurrects the use of nation states as units of analysis. International financial institutions, including the World Bank, the EU, the UN, the World Trade Organization, European and North American states, and many migrant-sending governments have all supported this model of development. This is a World Bank. It's a little old by now, but because it's before the crisis, the most recent crisis, but it gives you an idea of what got the World Bank and development agencies so excited about remittances, because you can see that in many cases remittances were larger than foreign aid. Okay, so that posed the transnational migrants as the heroes, the central agents in international development, according to this model. What's wrong with this fact? If the figures are there, well, as many critiques of this model have pointed out, this model poses migrants as a unified actor in terms of class and national interests, and identifies no contradictions between the impoverished populations of sending states, the handful of rich and middle class members of those states who might be migrants, and the national interests of sending and receiving countries. It represents a return to the modernization of model of the 1960s, but in a neoliberal world. In fact, the entire last chapter of Nations Unbound critiques this kind of thinking by disassembling the unified idea of the migrant as a single actor. There's the transnational family and daily life without structures of power problem, dead end number five. While the new assimilationists and the migration and development experts mark a rebirth of methodological, well, we've seen the rebirth of methodological nationalism in the four dead ends that I've mapped so far, another set of researchers took up the call to trace transnational networks, but without investigating intersection networks of power. We now have a great deal of descriptive material that documents the story of lives, families, organizations, responsibilities, identities, hopes, aspirations, and heartbreaks here and there. It's wonderful material, here, there, and elsewhere. Karen Ulwig, for example, argues, however, that families constitute a central socio-cultural framework of life where specific notions of livelihood emerge, which lead family members to engage in a wide array of migratory movements. She goes on to say, and I continue the quote, "At the same time, these notions of livelihood offer a concrete context of interpersonal relations that connect migrants with their place of origin and give substance to their ties to this place." So she's got like this concept of livelihood that sort of hovers out there, okay, in these transnational spaces that connect migrants across states. Now, the question I ask is, should we feel comfortable describing notions of transnational livelihood or transnational lives without reference to the institutional structures of villages, cities, and states, and of the globe-spanning corporate structures within which these notions are constructed and reshaped? Okay. So what do we do? Now, Nations Unbound and the transnational migration paradigm we developed emerged from our collective questioning of categories, our continued taken-for-granted assumptions about migration regimes, and the global conjuncture as we saw and experienced it in 1994. Our self-reflexivity about the paradigm we were developing was part of the call by social theorists to in, interrogate how analytical frameworks reflect and contribute to the intellectual and political and economic context in which they develop. We noted that our analysis was not only shaped by the fact that we are anthropologists and that Christina was a transmigrant, Linda and I were children of immigrants, and we were all embedded through participant observation in multiple networks. We were also aware that our differential social positioning in relationship to power influenced how we saw the world. The three of us came of age in an academic world in which women scholars tended to be marginalized. But caught in our efforts to reformulate the framework of migration scholarship, there were processes and structures we missed seeing. Theorizing from New York City, we missed the processes by which capital accumulation unevenly affected different cities of settlement. And I've been spending the last 10 years trying to theorize that. Striving to document the continuing hegemony of nation states to shape the identities and struggles and political struggles of migrants, we missed the significance of opportunity structures that vary with geography. But even more significantly, we made assumptions about the stasis of the regulatory regimes of migration. We assumed that there would be a continuation of the migration regimes of the 1980s and 90s, even as it began to dramatically be attenuated and transformed. Underlying our perspective on transnational family and on the various economic and political and cultural networks we traced was an expectation that while migrants faced precarities, they also generally had the possibility of settlement and attendant rights, including family reunion. That is to say, even if they arrived undocumented or with some kind of limited visa, work, or student, they'd be able to settle and build transnational foundations. 20 developments in the past 20 years, as well as our changing positionalities, have given us new insights. For example, when I moved to New Hampshire and began to study transnational migration there, I found that Manchester, New Hampshire, was not New York City. Now, that might seem obvious, but it wasn't in the migration theory at all. And I'm now the mother of five children facing various kinds of precarity with grandchildren who will come of age when the climate crisis is expecting to become overwhelming. Now, so today, what do we see that should expand the transnational migration paradigm? First of all, we see what Robin Cohn called the new helots. That is, people who are basically unfree labor because they're enmeshed in short-term contracts that give them absolutely no rights. Only the wealthy have the right to settle in this current historical conjuncture. And all this is taking place in the midst of global economic and political crisis that makes it more necessary and yet less possible for large numbers of people to migrate and settle and build transnational lives. Increasingly, as I showed, migrants are blamed for the widespread social, economic, and physical displacements that are taking place within the borders of nation states. The ever-growing anti-immigrant press, the call to defend borders from intruders, mentally poses all of us to fend off people who are increasingly seeking refuge from floods and ecological disasters caused by climate change. Already, people are now escaping from war, drought, and devastation, and yet are being allowed to drown in the Mediterranean. A migration industry of managed migration with a neoliberal public-private corporate structure is organized to profit from the trope of national security, criminalization, and deportation by providing surveillance, the tracking of migrant bodies, contract labor with limited rights to protest labor conditions or even leave a work site. Now, How are migration scholars to respond then to this current situation? I talked about the new assimilationists and the opposite trend, but is the new mobility studies. Okay. Now the new mobility studies glosses mobile people as all to be studied within the same framework. So billionaire, capitalists, tourists, students, contract workers, people who strive to move and settle, whether or not they have legal documents, they're all mobile people. Okay. Now, is there any utility in doing this? Well, yes and no. There's something to be learned, because by talking about mobile people, we can also talk about the regimes of mobility, or who defines who can be a mobile person and under what conditions, who gets criminalized merely because they cross the borders, who gets differentiated as migrants, while others are granted free passage, multiple privileges and identities, and aren't seen as migrants at all. However, what I'm suggesting here, and in the concluding section of this paper, I'm suggesting that what we need is, what would be much better, is a displacement studies. What Bella Feldman Bianco and colleagues in Latin America and at the IUAES have begun to talk about when they talk about displacement studies. So let me talk about how displacement studies can build on the transnational paradigm. I want to do this with a little bit of reflexivity, if I have the time. How much time do I have? I forgot to take your watch. Doing okay? Okay. Good, because I became fully aware of the need for displacement studies when I heard the response of colleagues at the University of Manchester to my research on a video project about climate change. In this project, virtual migrants, a group of performance artists, provided video training for refugees living in Manchester, UK. The refugees then interviewed each other, describing rains that didn't come, floods, and changes in local flora and fauna, which made planting crops or holding rituals very difficult. And they explained that these were being experienced by family and friends left behind. In presenting my findings about this project to my University of Manchester colleagues, I stressed how the refugees in the video project built upon their transnational connections to climate change in their homelands in order to self-identify as climate change activists who wanted to, quote, save the planet. This is the video project. The person with the glass, looking over, the man with the glasses is one of virtual migrants, and these are two of the women in the project. Reaching across their differences in nationality, religion, gender, and age, they join together with each other on the basis of what Paul Gilroy calls planetary humanism. In presenting my data, I traced the connections between the refugees' experiences of multiple displacement and the outlook and politics they were embracing. Listening to my presentation, several of my colleagues objected to my focus on migration. They asked about people who had never moved but are displaced from their access to employment, housing, health care, and hope by global and local restructuring. Through their questions, I began to understand the importance of theorizing displacement within the contemporary global conjuncture so that we can speak to daily life, mobility, stasis, economic and political crisis, climate change, and social movements for social justice and transformations in the global political economy within a single analysis. I suggest that the challenge to migration scholars at this time is to build from a global perspective on migration by linking those migrating to those displaced by all the contemporary restructuring processes of capital accumulation and dispossession. the current global situation must be understood in terms of the impact of new forms of capital accumulation, which include what Naomi Klein has called disaster capitalism that profits from global disaster and climate change. To do this, we must acknowledge that dispossession is at the heart of the constitution of capital. Capital is approached here in its Marxist sense as an unequal social relation in which surplus value is accumulated directly from labor or indirectly within the expropriation of resources and land. Dispossession may be a global process, but it happens in specific places and times. Some of the most useful scholarship on dispossession has been done through an analysis of urban restructuring processes with which we live every day in New York City, but in cities around the world, although in different ways. These appropriations are maintained ultimately by force, but simultaneously culturally legitimated by narratives of national, religious, and cultural difference. In developing this point, it is useful to read David Harvey through the work of Kignano's Coloniality of Power. The process of dispossession produces various forms of physical and social displacement. Displacement takes the form of development of local precariats, as well as migrations precipitated by war, so-called development, and structural adjustment and urban regeneration. The very people from whom wealth is extracted are increasingly cast out or cast as worthless, whether or not they are legal citizens of the country in which they live. That is to say, accumulation through dispossession is justified by categorizing those who are displaced as less than human. They become what Judith Butler has called the ungrievable other, stigmatized through processes of racialization, criminalization, and denial of the right to have rights. This has nothing to do with their culture or the inherent properties of the displaced. On the other hand, whether we consider ourselves natives or of migrant descent, anywhere around the world, we are subject to the forces of dispossession and displacement. On the other hand, migrants can no longer be constructed as a separate category of actors, but must be seen along with everyone else, with their multiple identities, disparate positionalities, and configurations of dispossession, experienced and subjectively constructed class positions and social fields. So, let me see, I'm probably a slide behind, because I really got into that. This is what I said about dispossession. I apologize. I've stressed the neoliberal restructuring, which highlights the significance of urban real estate, of global corporate private governance procedures and urban variations. And I'm going to conclude by saying Nations Unbound was concerned with the factors that made staying home or settling equally difficult for some people who cross borders. This question needs to be broadened today to an examination of the structures of unequal power that constitute all our lives and of the processes through which institutions, structures, and politics are constituted by people's individual and collective actions. In developing a new displacement studies that can contribute to social movements of the displaced, it is helpful to remember that our lives, as well as how we see the world, are, of course, not only shaped by, but also contribute to, the constitution of the current historical conjuncture. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nina. That was wonderful. I'd like to introduce now our discussant for this evening, Linda Bash, whose affiliations include Harvard University's Advanced Leadership Fellowship. She's an Athena Fellow at Barnard College and President Emerita of the National Council for Research on Women, now called ReGender. Linda's areas of expertise include globalization, economic security, impact of public policy on women and families, higher education, gender and diversity in academia, society in the workplace, and so on. She also has a PhD in anthropology from NYU, and she, as I mentioned before, is a co-author of Nations Unbound and has studied issues of migration, race, ethnicity, and gender. She has carried out fieldwork in the Caribbean, Africa, Middle East, North America. Also, she has written numerous articles and co-authored books. And she once served in my position, too, as a co-chair of New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section. And I welcome Linda as a discussant. Thank you.
So, thank you very much for inviting me. Can you see me? You can't see me. All right. Can you see me? So, I want to thank you especially for giving Nina and I the opportunity to work again, which is wonderful. And also to say, when I was co-chair of the anthropology section of the Academy, I did it with Brian, but I also did it with Nina. So that's another place where we were together. So what I want to say is, bravo, Nina. This is an amazing presentation. So I appreciate Nina drawing me into this retrospective look at Nations Unbound and the transnational paradigm we put forth 20 years ago. And while I first recognized and began studying elements of this phenomenon in the mid-1980s, by the mid-90s, I went off into academic deaning and then to heading up the National Council for Research on Women. Nina is the one who continued to work in and advance this area of scholarship and at the same time to chart new theoretical ground building on some of the understandings we arrived at. I want to begin by underscoring one of Nina's closing points. Nations Unbound was concerned with the factors that made staying home or settling equally difficult for some people who crossed borders. This question needs to be broadened today to an examination of the structures of unequal power that constitute all our lives and of the processes through which institutions, structures, and politics are constituted by people's individual and collective actions. I know it's a mouthful. How did we get to this point in our analysis from studying migrations in the 1980s and early 90s? What I want to do is give a bit of the backstory to how we developed our analysis and why I think the pegs of our theoretical formulation, the elements that we brought together, are as important and urgent today as they were then for understanding current migration realities. It's fitting that we begin this retrospective look at the New York Academy of Science, where much of it began, with much appreciation to Seidel Silverman, who was then heading Wenegren. When Nina and I and Christina first approached her asking to have a Wenegren conference focused on transnational migration, we were very excited with this new concept. Seidel suggested that we try it out first at the Academy and that we invite researchers working on migration to test our perspective using their data. The result was a rich two-day meeting in which some of you in this room participated. Hannah, you presented a paper there. And, of course, a volume in the Annals was one of the products. So where did our ideas come from? We need to give special thanks to Connie Sutton, who had been an academic advisor to both Nina and me. Connie had been observing migration since her early fieldwork in Barbados and also noticing the back-and-forth flows of ideas and their impact on consciousness. And Connie's the one who suggested that Nina, Christina, and I work together. She connected us, as she has done with so many scholars. And we were, of course, quite influenced by the analyses of global power dynamics by Wallerstein, Wolf, Sassen, and Harvey. While we had all been working in places where migration was a central aspect of life, the Anglo-Caribbean, Haiti, and the Philippines, we brought different theoretical interests to the table. Nina was particularly interested in understanding how global capitalism and changes in global capital relations affected a variety of social processes, as you heard more of tonight. Christina was interested in the forces of nationalism and what they meant in migrants' lives. And I was struck with the actual movements of people I was witnessing when I was working at the UN, examining and contrasting circum-Caribbean migration and migration to New York. In some cases, I couldn't recall where I had last seen some people. Was it St. Vincent, Grenada, Trinidad, or New York? Nonetheless, to deal with a particular blend of precarity and opportunity, So I was working at the time, as Nina mentioned, with two Trinidadian researchers, Rosina Wilcher and her brother Winston, who first actually used the term transnational. They saw it that way in part because of their own life histories. Their parents had come from Barbados to work in the asphalt industry that had mushroomed in Trinidad in the early 20th century, and their father, armed with accounting skills, was a member of the junior staff. Nonetheless, to deal with a particular blend of precarity and opportunity that members of the Wiltshire family confronted through the years, they spread their tentacles far and wide, then and continuing today, so that their present-day family reunions include a web of connections that span Barbados, Trinidad, England, Canada, and the U.S. Nina, Christina, and I engaged in a particular interweaving of ethnography and theory and of theorizing the interplay of structure and agency. We kept expanding the elements we drew into our analysis, which led us ultimately to encompass and address the power differentials of race, class, and nation states linked to global capitalism and their impacts on the strategies transmigrants employed. As Nina said, we looked at the interpenetration of the local, national, transnational, and global. Nina has done a good job of showing how much scholarship over the past 20 years has ignored some key points of our analysis that are important today, particularly the growing power differentials between nations that shape the way social, economic, and political goods are distributed and that create the insecurities that force many into migration. The structural adjustment policies recently imposed in the EU and the cases of Greece, Spain, and Portugal are just a later day example of these forces. I want to highlight some aspects of our analysis that I think are especially relevant for the present day, our insights on transnational family relations, the role of states, and the importance of understanding how the differential power of states affects migration strategies. I also want to say something briefly about the units of study and analysis that researchers select and how they can blind us to other important processes taking place, and lastly, to raise question about the public edge of our work. We showed the traditions of migration embedded in the Eastern Caribbean islands of St. Vincent and Grenada, the Philippines, and Haiti, and we anchored those traditions and the continuing emigration in the political economies of these states and their locations of vulnerability historically within broader forces of global capital dating back to their colonial experiences. We saw the necessity for transnational migration studies, but also their precariousness, and the obligations, responsibilities, and debt involved among family members, whether they were the actual migrants or remained behind. And we saw the inequalities that emerged within families within this larger frame of insecurity, including incipient class jockeying in which some family members benefited to the detriment of others. We also saw that transnational family networks were built within all classes and that migrant transnational networks are not homogeneous. Almost no one in these countries is immune to the insecurities forced by the larger field of global relations. The separations to this day that I followed in the Wiltshire family continue to be exhausting and hugely costly, with grandmothers shuttling between multiple sites in Canada, the U.S., and Great Britain to help their children raise their children. Family members have returned for periods to their home bases in economic downturns, and as the economy has tanked in Trinidad over the past few years, migrants intensified different parts of their transnational networks. We need more research on the dynamics of transnational family life, particularly during this time of restrictive immigration policies and increasing global insecurity when family members are often barred from entry and reunification opportunities are rapidly diminishing. Having studied transnational political and organizational ties in St. Vincent and Grenada, tiny countries with more people living outside their borders than inside, I was particularly taken with a conceptualization we called the deterritorialized nation state. When we used the term Nations Unbound, as Nina has said, we were not referring to a new post-state order. Rather, we were trying to show the various penetrations that nation-states experience and the strategies they develop that extend beyond the borders of their territories. This includes nationals living elsewhere as migrants who have allegiances that span national borders. We all studied immigrant leaders appealing to constituencies in Brooklyn as their country's largest constituency. As we can infer, this deterritorialized construction is mired in contradictions. Migrants' ideologies and perspectives are influenced by new experiences gained in their countries of settlement and engagement, as well as understandings developed at home. I saw both the Vincentian and Grenadian ambassadors to the UN, each who had lived in the U.S. many years, place votes in the UN that cut against their home country's interests and that were more reflective of U.S. interests and designs. We need to understand more about the ideological perspectives of migrants today, where their allegiances lie, and how they are subject to hegemonic understandings, often of several locations. When Al Baradei, a man who sat in an office next to mine for more than 2 years at the UN and who had very much a UN perspective, returned to Egypt to throw his hat in the ring to lead, I wondered how he would fare. And we can raise the same questions about the new leadership in Afghanistan. During my research in Grenada, I saw how Morris Bishop's attempts to challenge entrenched global forces of power were crushed. I'd like to say something about the units of study and analysis that we select. We can only see what we're looking at and what we encompass in our theories. Often, what's important gets left out of our purview because of the ways we bound our research. I think Nina has done a great job of showing how the narrowness of the fields of observation adopted by some contemporary researchers blinds them to some of the larger forces and differentials of power that shape transnational migration and networks today, and also the displacements that Nina's talking about. Take, for example, the way some countries are looking to migrants and their remittances or savings as a form of potential development, and which some researchers are heralding. I remember my research partner Rosina Wiltshire saying, if countries start tapping migrant savings for their development strategies, heaven help the migrants. And Rosina was the UNDP resident representative for the Eastern Caribbean, charged with bringing development to the area. Her comments were a response to the narrow productive bases of the many emigrant-producing countries we were observing. Both St. Vincent and Grenada, which are largely agricultural, have few projects to stimulate development on their drawing boards, which in large part reflects their limited resource bases and also the evolving interests of their political elites. Nina's slide on the small ratio of foreign aid to migrant remittances is eye-opening. For without investment in local infrastructure and the creation of structures that ensure the security of investments, migrants' investments in local projects will yield little for the migrants or their countries, as we saw when we were doing our research. My last point deals with a public anthropology. There is large anti-immigrant sentiment in many places, and borders are tightening against migrants. Nina is calling for anthropologists and others working on transnational migration to develop analyses and frameworks through which we can today sort out the transnational networks at play within various conflicts, the role of entrenched corporate interests, including the arms industries, and the desperation and aspirations of people left with no place to go and nothing to hope for. Some of the pegs of this type of research are contained within Nations Unbound. How do we bring this perspective to students and researchers of transnational migration today to build these understandings? And then, how do we bring them to the attention of key publics? In closing, I'd like to thank you for listening to these presentations. This is the first effort, 20 years post-publication of Nations Unbound, to take the perspectives we developed then out to colleagues and new audiences to discuss with them the current usefulness of this approach. And Nina has already jumped into the whole area of displacement. We're eager for your response, so thank you.